Good morning. You are tuned to KBOO Portland. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, your host today for the Old Mole Variety Hour. The music you are listening to is called Won't Give Up by Patty Gonia in collaboration with Yo-Yo Ma and Quinn Christofferson. KBOO is now at the end of our fall campaign to raise $75,000 in support of the community radio shows you love. At a time when our progressive and inclusive activist space is under the greatest threat in our 56-year history, we call on our listeners to support us. If you give today, your donation will be matched dollar for dollar by a group of generous donors. You can donate by going to kboo.fm/give, by clicking the red box Donate in the mobile app, by texting KBOO to 44321, or by mailing a check to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, 97214. KBOO thanks you. Today, the moles are focusing on climate change. We have some good news on that front. In their Left and the Law segment, Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker will take a look at the decision just handed down by the Supreme Court of Montana, which upheld a lower court decision that the state is violating residents' constitutional right to a clean environment by permitting oil, gas, and coal projects without regard for their effect on global warming. Before that, as your well-read read, I will be reviewing a book that grapples with a critical question for climate justice activists. What explains humanity's collective failure to avert the existential threat posed by climate change? The book is called The Great Derangement by Amitav Ghosh. We're going to get started with Laurie Mercier in conversation with Dr. Zainab Shuker about the long-term environmental impacts of U.S. and Israeli wars in the Middle East. It's estimated that the world's militaries combined emit about 5.5% of all global greenhouse gas emissions based on their fuel usage alone. But military conflict, as Dr. Shuker explains, contributes a lot more to global warming through its many direct and indirect impacts on people and the environment. Here's Laurie with Dr. Zainab Shuker.
Good morning. I'm speaking with Zainab Shuker, who is an assistant professor of sociology at Sam Houston State University and a fellow at the Century Foundation. Her research focuses on comparative global political economy and climate change, with special emphasis on the Middle East in general and Iraq in particular. Today, we're talking about environmental impacts of the United States and Israeli wars in the region. Welcome to KBOO, Professor Shuker.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, most everyone is aware of the horrific genocide in Gaza, but it has been surprising to me that environmental groups have largely not raised alarms about the ecocide, the utter environmental destruction of Gaza, or about the emissions and toxicity that extend beyond the region as a result of Israel's bombardment and the weapons deployed. Could you outline for us the catastrophic conditions Israel's war has inflicted on the environment?
Yeah, absolutely. I think oftentimes when we are thinking of the environment or climate change and environmental degradation in relation to Gaza, at least in the sort of early days after October 7th, it seems that it was not a priority. And I think that's sort of where the problem lies. Compared to sort of what people and organizations feel as like an immediate urgent issue, like displacement, bombing, deaths, et cetera. So it seemed like the environment was not a priority. But I think the environment is incredibly an essential part of the story. The environment has been weaponized for a very long time in not just Gaza, but in the Palestinian territories for decades. And I think it's important to know that Israel's weaponization of natural resources and the environment extend before October 7th, and not only in Gaza, but in several locations. For instance, there has been a blockade in Gaza since 2007, and Israel has been refusing and not allowing the entrance of any kind of equipment to update infrastructure for like water purification, to deal with sewage, to deal with garbage collection, and so on. So the environmental damage has been intentional for a very long time before the October 7th events. And so when October 7th hit, it just continue that assault, really. The first few days, Israel did not allow or cut water, gas, and electricity completely on the Gaza Strip. Eventually, it opened for some of it to enter the disaster zone, really. But it was not enough. And then afterwards, there was specific targeting of destroying whatever left of the infrastructure, the outdated infrastructure. Before October 7th, waterborne illnesses used to be the main cause of child death in the Gaza Strip. After October 7th, just the condition even worsened. Today we see just many, many different waterborne diseases, diseases due to pollution, due to collection of garbage, due to sewage system leaking into the ocean, into the sea. And so really the assault had started before and continued, and there was specific targeting of the infrastructure and the natural resources, and the consequences are severe on health, on safety, on stability, and just basic human rights, really.
And what are the long-term consequences for Palestinians in Gaza and the larger region?
So we know that the region in general, the Middle East region, is highly vulnerable to climate change. It's one of the most impacted regions globally to climate conditions and worsening climate conditions. And so to respond to that, and we know climate is impacting every place, it's not just the Middle East, but the Middle East is very vulnerable because of limited ability and capacity of different states to respond to climate change. And so in a place like Gaza, where the infrastructure already destroyed, the community, the society is wounded, and it will take decades to fix these wounds, like physical wounds and emotional and psychological wounds. It just lowers the resilience in terms of responding to climate change and responding to environmental degradation. Israel, for instance, have for a very long time made sure to target olive trees and cut sort of like the natural, like the trees that grow naturally in these areas. That itself increased temperatures, impact the soil, and lower precipitation levels. You need all of these things to be able to respond and become more resilient to climate conditions. So destroying the natural habitat, destroying the native trees, destroying the infrastructure, polluting the environment even more, it's just going to increase temperatures, it's going to lower precipitation, it's going to increase pollution, which means climate change is going to impact Palestine specifically and the region more severely. And the thing with climate is that it doesn't stop at a border. So it's the damage is not going to end with just the border of the Gaza Strip. The increase in temperature is going to affect everyone, even Israel. And so it's not limited to one location. And the destruction and conflict and war means people are, they are already behind, and now they're even more behind in terms of building resilient infrastructure and spaces and institutions to address the climate crisis, which make the region as a whole really vulnerable, impact Israel as well. It's Israel is not safe from their own practices in Gaza.
And certainly U.S. policies and supporting Israel's war, but U.S. bombing in the region has certainly exacerbated climate change. And even with the recent fall of the Assad government in Syria, the United States and Israel were bombing before Assad left and now after Assad has left. So this kind of constant bombardment in the region, it seems to me, has largely been ignored by the environmental movement in terms of recognizing it as severely exacerbating climate change and climate catastrophe.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we need to think of sort of conflict and like the bombing of different countries and communities in the Middle East by whether the US or Israel. It has sort of direct consequences and indirect consequences on the environment, and all of it is long term. So the direct consequences we're thinking of, like bombing a place and destroying the building, destroying a forest, destroying the field, which is very damaging to the environment, right? There's a lot of pollutions. There's a lot of, the weapons itself, what they produce and what they send out in the atmosphere. The movement of weapons from point A to point B is very polluting to the environment. Destroying fields, destroying, like I mentioned, water resources, etc. That's like a very direct consequence of conflict and bombing. But there's also the indirect consequences, like I mentioned a little bit with like the situation in Gaza, but also the behavior of the US in the region for really decades. When you are bombing a place, you are increasing political instability. You are displacing people. You are pushing the country's resources toward maybe rebuilding and dealing with insecurity, etc. So you don't have enough capacity, state capacity, or enough resources to address things like climate resilience. So there's like an indirect consequence because you are, focusing on trying to survive and rebuilding your own country, or trying to deal with, let's say, terrorist groups that emerge because of this sort of power vacuum. And so you don't have enough time or space to work on environmental related things. When you are bombing a place, people are displaced. When they're displaced, their farms where they left behind is destroyed, and they move to like towns or locations where they put even more pressure on resources. So that lowers environmental and climate resilience. It just one thing related to the other, from short term to long term, to direct consequences to indirect consequences. And the simplest thing is just moving of weapons from point A to point B itself is highly polluting and damaging. And the US, for instance, has been doing this, moving a lot of weapons and supporting Israel for the past couple of months. And that itself has been contributing to green gas emissions. So the damage is severe, of supporting and engaging in conflict. And often that conflict tend to happen in these locations, like the Middle East. The US doesn't necessarily pay the consequences, the environmental consequences of their sort of aggression, but the countries and communities and societies where the aggression is happening, they're the one who have to deal with that for generations to come.
Well, Zeynep Shukr, much of your work has focused on the legacy of the US invasion of Iraq. Now, over 20 years later, what lessons might we learn about the long-term environmental consequences of that war on the region?
So the situation with Iraq is really devastating, I believe. Like we mentioned, that the whole region is highly vulnerable, but Iraq is one of the most vulnerable countries to that, to climate change and to environmental degradation. And the damage, again, it's decades in the making. For instance, in the first Gulf War, the US targeted a lot of infrastructure, and the economic sanctions that followed meant that a lot of the infrastructure that were destroyed were not being updated in terms of, let's say, capturing flared gas. Iraq is an oil-producing economy, and it produces a lot of gas that's flared, like burned in the air, which is really damaging to the environment. And for decades, Iraq did not develop infrastructure and tools and resources to capture that gas. And a big part of it is the legacy of conflict, whether again directly destroying infrastructure and facilities, or indirectly by sort of empowering in many ways governments that are dysfunctional and not interested into sort of developing the economy or addressing the environmental crisis. And so gas has been being flared in Iraq for decades. And then 2003 happened, and very problematic sort of political system was empowered in a place like Iraq that's based on sort of sect and ethnic-based divisions in the country, meaning that a lot of these different political actors were empowered and by international forces like the US now hold their position, and they contribute to not operating and not running the country effectively. And the environment was one of the consequences, and one of the sort of casualties of that poor governing. Again, we're talking about decades in the making of damage, and decades in the making of neglect and direct assault against the environment and empowering political leaders who not environmental friendly. In fact, these political leaders like Saddam Hussein, for instance, will dry the Iraqi marshland in southern Iraq, which is really important to environmental resilience in the country. He dried that. He dried the wetland for war purposes and for punishment of the population at the time because of an uprising against him. And so there is a very long, complicated legacy. And today, Iraq is one of the most vulnerable countries. Today, the country is experiencing major water shortage, poor quantity and quality of water. We are seeing more and more climate displacement. Folks are forced to leave, sort of their thousands of year tradition of farming the land. We have, people who lived on these land for many, many generations and who have, very strong cultural and social connection to the land. And now they cannot sustain it because of environmental change and climate change and environmental degradation. And they're forced to leave. And they're forced to be displaced into shanty towns. And we are putting them in a situation where they lack resources and they lack support. So they're like more likely to engage in maybe conflict. They're more likely to not have access to better healthcare, to good education. And so we are now experiencing a decline in agriculture, a societal breakdown, and possible political and economic breakdown in the future if nothing is being addressed. Part of it is an Iraqi problem because of Iraqi politicians. Part of it is also the legacy of many generations and many decades of conflict by international forces who did not prioritize the environment or the well-being of the population and their interactions with Iraq and the Middle East.
And you raised this issue of a water shortage affecting Iraq because of these past policies and practices. And we often think about Iraq and Iran and other countries in the region having the resource curse of oil. But you also write about how water has been a source of conflict. And we see this motivating Israel to seize Palestinian lands and water resources. And as we see climate change worsen, drought also threatens sustainability and survival throughout the region. What has happened or what could affect the water supply in Iraq?
So the water supply in Iraq is really a combination of it's facing a combination of internal poor management, impact of neighboring countries, and just the climate crisis that's impacting the globe in general. So it's multi-layered. Iraq today face a major water shortage. Iraq is the land between the two rivers, right? It's the Tigris and the Euphrates, and it's been the source of life in that land for thousands of years. These earliest civilizations, Sumerians and Akkadians and so on, managed to establish cities and empires around water. And agriculture was part of that. And cities would not have emerged, and with it, writing, the wheel, religion, etc., probably would not have emerged without the presence of water and the stability it presented. And so water is an important part of the Iraqi identity, economically, socially, politically. Today, Iraq is facing a major water shortage. Again, part of it is this legacy of bombing and destroying infrastructure and the lack of available resources and equipment to rebuild these this infrastructure. And so we see today water that's incredibly polluted, very poor quality of water that's making farming almost impossible in many locations in the country. Again, farming is sort of an essential part of the story, of the historical story, of the current story, of people's economic, social, and cultural well-being, and farming becoming more and more, and fishing as well, right? Becoming more and more challenging because of the deteriorated water quality. But quantity is decreasing as well. And part of it is that we are seeing neighbors like Iran and Turkey. So Iraq is a downstream country. The both of the rivers are originate outside of Iraq, right? In Turkey. And so Turkey is also facing its own water shortage issues. And so it's been building dams for decades, limiting how much water is coming down to Iraq. Iran is also facing its own water shortage issues, and it's limiting how much water coming down to Iraq. And the Iraqi state, dysfunctional as it is, is not negotiating effectively with these countries, is not investing into better infrastructure, it's not investing into addressing sort of the internal environmental conditions to improve quality and quantity. And so there is a combination of these things together making just less and less water entering the country, and whatever it's there, it's oftentimes not good for use in terms of drinking or even farming. And of course, there's the climate crisis where really every country in the region, again, Turkey, Iran, even countries that's slightly more stable than Iraq, thinking of Turkey, they are facing their own water shortage because of increasing population and because of just the climate crisis and lack of precipitation. The difference is that they have more capacity and resources to capture their water and to build dams and infrastructure to mitigate the damage and the shortage. In the case of Iraq, the capacity doesn't exist or very limited, combined with corruption and focus on other things like investing only in the oil and energy sector, meaning that the country is not even taking effective or meaningful step to address the water shortage. So that is eventually going to lead to a major source of instability in the country. And again, instability in one place and climate and environmental degradation in one place doesn't stop at the border. Last year, for example, there was many sandstorms that hit Iraq because of limited precipitation and increases in temperatures. These sandstorms were not limited to Iraq. They made their way to Kuwait. They made their way to Iran. Sandstorms being you have to shut down schools, you have to shut down work, transportation become difficult. It's not only Iraq is going to pay for it, the neighbors will pay for it, except that there's no effective collaboration in the Middle East in general, really, not just Iraq, in terms of addressing this crisis that's impacting the whole region.
Well, Zainab Shukr, in the remaining minute or two that we have, what can be done to mediate climate disasters in the region? I know that's a long list, but how can we raise attention and greater alarm about U.S. policies in the region and what we can do to try to rein in what the United States is doing in terms of exacerbating climate disaster?
So I think a lot of the change needs to happen from within. I think that a lot of political actors need to be held accountable, institutions need to be rebuilt, civil activists need to have the freedom and the space to operate inside countries like Iraq. So there is definitely a lot of change needs to happen within. We cannot enforce change from the outside. We have seen over and over again that this is not the most effective tool and practice. But at the same time, like I mentioned, it's not only an internal problem, it's an external problem. So I think for what people in the US can do and activists and just the average person is to hold causers of environmental degradation accountable, hold Israel accountable and its environmental practices, hold the US accountable in terms of its support and its sort of active engagement in conflict in the region, hold oil and gas companies, US and oil gas companies, accountable in how they operate in places like the Middle East. Oftentimes, these companies underreport or do not report accurately the emissions and the environmental damage they cause in places like Iraq. And because the country is fragmented and there's not enough political sort of systems of checks and balances, they can get away with it. So hold these companies accountable, hold the government accountable, and recognize that environmental degradation is part of conflict and it's a cause of conflict and it's a weapon of conflict. It's not something that happened afterwards. It's not something that once we build a city or take care of ceasefire, then we have to worry about the environment later. The environment is part of the story. And we cannot talk about sort of building resilient, strong societies without also addressing how the climate is very much part of that story and how the environment is very much part of that story.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Zainab Shukr. We will link to some of your very important work on the Old Mole Variety website on KBOO. Thanks again.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. He my little baby Medusa, tipping the juice up. I go back and forth in an Uber, travel for 2 months. I'm the emptiest, hallelujah. Open my chest up, it's a rabbit inside my hat. Angel all dressed up, looking to bless up with the milk and the honey gates. I make money for money's sake, I've been writing 100 days to the wretched out the earth and called it baby for none. And on my shoulder blades, a shattered wings to carry me home. I said, baby, come on.
That was No Name with a song called Rainforest. Before that, Laurie Mercier was speaking with Dr. Zainab Shuker about the Middle East, war, and the climate crisis. The Old Mole Collective has hosted one of the longest-lived shows on KABU. We've brought onto our show hundreds of local activists involved in a huge diversity of progressive projects to talk about their work. We're part of the glue that unites our community. Today is a great day to donate to KABU because your donation will be matched, dollar for dollar, by a group of generous donors. You can donate by going to kboo.fm/give, by clicking the red box Donate in the mobile app, by texting KBOO to 44321, or by mailing a check to KABU at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, 97214. The KABU community thanks you. When local elites decided to erect a new port on a river southeast of Calcutta, weather scientist Henry Piddington sent them a stern warning. Everyone and everything must be prepared to see a day, he wrote, when in the midst of the horrors of a hurricane, they will find a terrific mass of salt water rolling in or rising up upon them with such rapidity that the whole settlement will be inundated to a depth from 5 to 15 feet. The warning was ignored. The port was built with banks, hotels, a railway station, and grand public buildings. 3 years after its inauguration, a cyclone struck along with a storm surge and swept the city away. The unthinkable had happened. The year was 1867. Writer and environmentalist Amitav Ghosh recounts this anecdote in his 2016 book, called The Great Derangement. Ghosh claims it as an early example of people's failure to grasp and prevent the catastrophic, the unthinkable. What Ghosh means by the Great Derangement is our modern-day collective inability to take the measures needed to avert the existential threat of global warming. To explain this profound failure to save our own skins, Ghosh explores human ways of thinking as they are shaped by literature, history, and politics. In the first of three essays that comprise the book, Ghosh notes how the 20th century literary novel, unlike the storytelling that prevailed during earlier eras, emphasizes style, observation, character, and nuance of emotion. It's all about individual moral adventure and tends to be exceedingly narrow in scope. Plot and narrative have been relegated to the genres like romance, thrillers, and horror. If the author writes about climate change, it's science fiction. And who takes that seriously? Further expelled from this form of storytelling is any agency or intelligence that is not human. Nature is conceived of as static and passive. There are no catastrophes. The unthinkable is exiled from the stories altogether. All of this, Ghosh writes, makes climate change events peculiarly resistant to the customary frames that literature has applied to nature. They are too powerful, too grotesque, too dangerous, and too accusatory to be written about in a lyrical or elegiac or romantic vein. Surely Ghosh overstates his case, you're thinking. Richard Powers' prize-winning novel Overstory comes immediately to mind. Or Ministry of the Future by Kim Stanley Robinson. But, in fact, it is well documented that during the fierce anti-communism following World War II, the CIA enlisted the famed Iowa Writers' Workshop to promote fiction that championed American individualism and took as its subject matter the routines of everyday life. How the CIA accomplished this is beyond the scope of this review, but their success can be attested to by anyone who has taken a writing workshop in the past few decades. As Ghosh writes, It was exactly the period in which the human activity was changing the Earth's atmosphere that the literary imagination became radically centered on the human. In the second section of the book, Ghosh takes up the ideas of history, and in particular, as he puts it, the Western world's enormous intellectual commitment to the promotion of its supposed singularity. In this worldview, the countries of the global north were the ones with the ingenuity and energy to drive technological advance, which diffused outward to what they thought of as the lazy and stupid masses of the global south. That view ignores how colonization brutally repressed the modern development of the colonized. It was not until after World War II, when the colonized threw off their overlords, that we get the so-called Great Acceleration, or that rapid growth in human activity that drove a massive increase in development, energy use, and, of course, greenhouse gas emissions. So the fly in the ointment of modern liberation is the climate crisis. Within the constrained thinking of Western exceptionalism lies the idea that everyone across the globe could enjoy the fruits of capitalist consumerism. As one liberal diehard explained to me, he just wanted a world in which everyone could eat the occasional steak, drive an electric car, and fly off to the Caribbean islands once a year for a nice vacation. Global economic equality in the context of sustainable carbon emissions was his dream. Ghosh, however, cites evidence that worldwide economic equality that does not burn up the planet would require something like an 80 to 90% reduction in the expenditures of the wealthy industrialized nations. There goes your car and your vacation, not to mention your meat. Who in the global north is going to go for that? So the remedies for climate justice become truly unthinkable. In Ghosh's words, the universalist premise of industrial civilization was a hoax. That a consumerist mode of existence, if adopted by a sufficient number of people, would quickly become unsustainable and would lead literally to the devouring of the planet. In the final essay of the book, Ghosh turns to politics and what he calls the most important concept of the modern era, freedom. But non-human forces, he argues, have no place in the human project to free ourselves from injustice, oppression, and inequality. So it follows that freedom becomes a war on nature, an effort to free ourselves from material constraints. Here you can think of the various far-fetched ideas to outrun our carbon emissions through technological inventions that let us keep on consuming. Coincident with this modern conception of freedom, Ghosh charts a failure of politics to effectively engage with climate change. Modern politics, he states, has devolved to fights over identity, has much more to do with individual human rights than promotion of the common good. Again, I think he overstates his case. Across the globe, resistance to the international corporate elite that perpetuates global roasting has grown remarkably. Yet the point is well taken when you look at fragmentation within the left and its tendency to devour its young. At exactly the time, Ghosh writes, when it has become clear that global warming is in every sense a collective predicament, humanity finds itself in the thrall of a dominant culture in which the idea of the collective has been exiled from politics, economics, and literature alike. Where then does Ghosh find hope and inspiration? In a very telling exercise, he meticulously compares the language of the Paris Agreement with Pope Francis's encyclical on climate change. It's prime evidence for his argument that humankind will find its salvation in the sacred, that nation-states with their narrow economic interests will not lead us out of our predicament, but rather a global and religiously inspired movement that draws on moral purpose to uplift the common good. Ghosh does not argue that all we have to do is see the coming catastrophe and we'll be saved. The structural forces that maintain humanity on a path to self-destruction are formidable and will require courage and determination and hard work to overturn. But changing course demands that we see clearly who we are and where we are headed. This is Patricia Kohlberg, and I've been sharing my thoughts about a very interesting and provocative book called The Great Derangement by environmentalist and novelist Amitav Ghosh. That was a little bit of Jimmy Cliff with his 1991 song, Save Our Planet Earth. Before that, I was talking about The Great Derangement by Amitav Ghosh. KABU brings together on the airwaves a broad coalition of music and conversation and activism from all corners of our community. If you are able, please help us reach our year-end goal of raising $75,000. If you give today, your donation will be matched dollar for dollar by a group of generous donors. You can donate by going to kboo.fm/give, by clicking the red box, Donate, in the mobile app, by texting KBOO to 44321, or by mailing a check to KABU at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, 97214. We turn now to our Left in Law segment with Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker, who discussed the recent ruling by the Montana State Supreme Court that the state is, in fact, obligated to protect its residents from the harms of climate change. It's a big legal victory for climate justice.
Well, Mike, we've covered climate cases in the courts for some time now and have chronicled their agonizingly slow pace and often inconclusive outcomes. But there was a beautiful moment of clarity this month with the Montana Supreme Court upholding the landmark decision in the first ever youth climate lawsuit to go on trial in the U.S. And we covered the success of that case last summer, and now the Supreme Court has ruled in their favor on appeal. Can you tell us about the case, a brief history of it, and its significance, this Supreme Court ruling this month?
It's the Held versus Montana case. Its significance is this is the first jury trial we've had about whether or not human activity causes climate change and whether the court has the right to or is bound to take action that would modify this global heating. And it's no small issue. I mean, 2024 will be the hottest year on record. The United States here is now the biggest oil producer in the world. We put out 13 million barrels of oil every day. It's a huge part of the economy. That's 20% of all the world's oil. And so what this lawsuit has done practically is lead to the potential suspension of the construction of a natural gas plant in Montana. What's happening with using youth? Youth are people who are too young to vote, they can't affect change through the political process. First, the court found that they had standing to sue, and then found that the state, after a trial, violates their right to a clean and healthful environment under Montana's constitution. A judge declared that a Montana law proving this natural gas plant violated the right because Montana stopped who tried to stop all agencies from considering climate impacts when conducting environmental reviews. There was a trial, the first constitutional climate trial, that experts from oil companies, experts from plaintiffs, a lot of people, names are familiar to you from climate talks with Jim Hansen, people like that showed up, all kinds of experts. And ultimately, the judge wrote a 100-page opinion, which basically said that the state has a constitutional right. So other cases have relied on the public trust documents, that basically the right to due process includes the right to life and liberty it's infringed by the climate. But Montana has a very explicit part of its constitution devoted to the environment. It's the strongest decision on climate change issued by any court anywhere. It's very detailed. It's 100 pages. In every respect, the court agreed with the plaintiffs that fossil fuel combustion is the main cause of climate change, and that climate change is having all kinds of terrible health and environmental impact, which will get worse unless we stop fossil fuel emissions.
So, Mike, what do you think the arguments and counterarguments in play at the Supreme Court level, how did they differ from the trial? Because I watched the concluding arguments. Actually, it's quite interesting to watch them. You can watch them online on Vimeo. And it seemed like the arguments were the same as those at trial, although the attorneys for the state seemed to emphasize the overreach of the lower court ruling, and that there were enough ways of using the permitting process to protect citizens if there were concerns about the health impact of permits. And then the justices and several of them said, so like, what would be an example of how citizens could influence this? But it seems like a replay in a way of the lower court. What is critically different about decisions at the Supreme Court level?
Well, you're talking about the Supreme Court of Montana. Yeah, well, it's really, it's finally, like everything within the law, it's political. A good contrast is shown by what happened to the Giuliani case. Same type of case brought in Oregon and Eugene. A really great district court judge ruling, and Aiken ruled that it was a critical matter, the most important issue around, that the plaintiffs did have standing. But finally, the Ninth Circuit banned them from going forward, just smushed the whole case.
Did it matter that the Giuliani case was with the federal government versus this with the state of Montana?
Well, legally, it mattered very little, because the rationale of the Ninth Circuit in its Giuliani opinion was that plaintiffs, the kids there, had no standing to bring a claim for relief, ordering the government to implement a plan to phase out fossil fuel emissions, because the courts couldn't really do anything that would provide relief, because no declaratory judgment is going to suffice to stop catastrophic climate change. The court basically threw up its hand and said, such a remedy is just beyond the power of an Article III court.
And that there would have to be so many institutions at the federal government in providing relief, right?
They fled, as is not uncommon in the law, to a gross exaggeration of the remedy. They weren't being asked to stop all catastrophic climate change. They acted as if that was what the plaintiffs were demanding. But there are concrete measures that can be taken. There's a whole variety of measures that could be taken if there was a will enough to do it. China has... it's reprehensible in some ways with all the coal use and all the nuclear power use, but they've also done a tremendous amount of building of solar energy fields, some of them like many football fields the size, wind energy, and they have spent over $200 billion making it possible and easy to own an electric car in China. They've got tens of thousands of charging location, getting rid of range anxiety. You can always find a place to charge your car.
Of course, they don't have to worry about the permitting process, because they steamroll ahead with these things. And I know liberalizing the permitting process has also been a controversy among environmentalists with renewables. How do we reform the permitting process? But here it seems like I think the general principle that the public has a right to participate in looking at the impacts on the health and welfare of citizens is a principle that could be taken into review of renewable permitting as well, could it not?
Sure, it could. I mean, China has the great advantage of being a steamroller, just as you said. They also get real results. The number of particulate matters in big cities in China is down over 15%. the air is markedly, even dramatically better in Beijing and Shanghai and Wuhan than it was 20 years ago. So this can be done. And in California, for example, they're trying to bring about good results by forcing cars to eventually, and not too long in the future, by 2035, get rid of all fossil fuels. And the EPA has given California exemptions from other requirements since the days of Richard Nixon and the EPA's first existence. They've let California have exceptions to clean air requirements in order to charge ahead and make requirements on cars, which are sold there in greater numbers than anywhere else, and more restrictive of the particulates they emit. Now, Trump, of course, has this within his sights. The U.S. Supreme Court, which is now full of Trumpistas, has ruled against the EPA in major ways, holding it generally in about agencies of all sorts, most particularly the EPA, have limits on their powers. It's always unknown between when a legislature passes a law, then the executive branch of government carries it out. And what are going to be the details? The devil is always in the details. How far can they go in order to achieve the legislative intent? Well, Trump and the many members of the Supreme Court want to severely limit what an agency can do. At the same time, they want to limit the budget and the funding of this whole process. So what's going to happen over the next year, 2 years, and 3 years in terms of cars, I think most decisively is going to go on in California. Can California continue to make ever more stringent rules about what emissions are permissible from cars?
Because the size of California's economy drives a lot of what happens elsewhere, right?
There are 15 states who have followed California's lead. This is a big chunk, in fact, maybe even more than half of the entire automobile industry. So it's a big deal. We've seen it's a big deal from the concrete results in the air. The air's dramatic improvement in China. We've seen it in Los Angeles, which was far worse in the 1970s than it is now. There are things that can be done. There are rules that can be passed. There are laws and there are constitutional rights that are only implemented and only become meaningful in a concrete way. And if the right to a clean air, to a life and liberty, which is serious, particularly life, which is seriously impinged by fossil fuel emissions, then the judges have a right, even a duty, to take action. And the fact that they can't solve the whole problem does not mean they can't do something.
I was wondering about your thoughts on Montana's unique constitutional provision for guaranteeing or providing a healthy environment for citizens. And only a few other states have similar environmental provisions in their constitutions. How critical is that? And is it like many things in the law where you use what you have, and that's what they have, but it's not the only legal anchor for these cases?
Well, it's a big help, no question about that. The fact that there is a specific provision in their constitution, and New York's is very good as well, addressing the environment directly makes it somewhat easier. But other states are not without remedy if they don't have a particular clause. All sorts of trust doctrines about maintaining a harm-free or a pollution-free environment are present in every state's law and arguably present in the U.S. Constitution and the due process right. The rights to privacy, the rights to health, for example, threats to health even for prisoners if it's a deliberately malicious hospital, effectively shorten the lives of prisoners. Well, measures taken outside the prison in the larger society that affect people's health violate the existing constitutions. So there are legal remedies, but if there's a will, there is a way anywhere. But there's no doubt that that specific language in Montana is very encouraging. It was a big part of what the Montana Supreme Court ruled on, the fact that that clause had been added to the Constitution recently. Gave
real, and upheld, right?
Yeah, absolutely, yes.
You make a point that I think often gets lost in the worry about the world around us falling apart with each day. You know, their insurance companies are, of course, very worried about how much coastal space is uninhabitable, uninsurable, all kinds of weather effects that are also very expensive for the federal government. But, you know, you also emphasize that there have been gains in the history of the environmental movement. Even the formation of the Environmental Protection Agency itself came out of a social movement. And the flying into Los Angeles is different than it was when I was going to graduate school in the 1970s. And it was like descending into a mud puddle. This is an important point to emphasize, that there have been gains where serious collective efforts supported by the state have intervened around environmental crises.
Well, the most discouraging thing to me right now is something that Jeffrey St. Clair included along with his detailed discussion of all the environmental disasters around the world during the last year of 2024. And that is the growing.
You're talking about a Counterpunch article?
Yeah, he had a Counterpunch article on public, dated December 20th. Really excellent review of environmental disasters. If you have any doubt or question about the extent of climate change and what's resulting from the climate change that's going on, read his piece in Counterpunch. But he also includes there something that I've felt and is now articulated, in that there is a growing despair among people, Democrats, young people, people who've been engaged by climate change, in the likelihood or possibility or political reality of any change. The fact that the climate is changing in a bad way is not seriously in dispute anymore. But whether or not people can do anything about it, people's sense has dropped from like 60% to 49% since 2018. There's a greater sense of despair on this question. And these things are cyclical. There have been moments of intense concern in the early 70s that led to the creation of the EPA. But there have been laggardly times, and I think now we're in a time that, despite storms that recently killed thousands of people on islands, two of the most severe hurricanes ever in Florida, fires in Canada that have not stopped for years. We're having all kinds of really dramatic climate change that's happening here and now, and people just seem to, rather than try to squarely address it, they're thinking that it's just something to adapt to.
Yeah, so movements have a way of emerging in unexpected times and places. So I think we will be seeing activism. And I think one of the developments that I think has been important over the last year, or even to the Black Lives Matter movement in recent years, is how many young activists are making connections between the military industrial complex, the vast investment in weapons, even the environmental impact of the horror and genocide in Gaza, racism and the structural racism in this country, including in the legal carceral system. So, but that makes it a very big project too, to call for reforms on something so big that calls for something more revolutionary in terms of how the economy is run and how we go about making things and living on this planet.
Well, everything is connected, absolutely. I mean, China has spent $230 billion over the last 13 years. We could have done that too, but we have to maintain troops in 85 countries around the world. We have hundreds of bases overseas. We have other places for our money. So we don't have $200 billion to create charging stations and develop an alternative to the fossil fuel system in the internal combustion engine.
So militarism is a big part of the problem.
A huge part. I think it's the center part. The cost of maintaining an empire is the biggest threat to the United States.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a point to conclude on today, Mike. We know not too much happy talk today at the end of the year, but we want to celebrate and raise a glass to these young plaintiffs who stayed with this case. It was very endearing seeing them all in the courtroom, including with the Montana Supreme Court. They were all there, and their attorney turned to them, and it must have had some effect on those justices, because they were quite a winsome bunch. Even though they're older now, they're still pretty young.
Well, it was a fabulous result with lots of juicy details that'll be reproduced in other climate-related litigation. So, yeah, things come and things go. We need to persevere until some event will happen, I think, that will trigger a massive wave of support for stopping the global heating process to the extent that we can do it.
Okay. Have a good holiday, and we'll see you on Left in the Law in the new year. We'll have plenty to cover.
We will. Take care, Jen.
Thanks, Mike.
That was The Left in the Law with Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker talking about climate crisis and the courts. That brings our show to a close. I want to thank Moles, Lori Mercier, Jan Hocken, and Mike Snedeker for their contributions, and a special thanks to our guest, Dr. Zainab Shukar. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, and I've been your host for the hour. It's imperative during these uniquely perilous times that our community comes together to support each other and resist the rise of the extreme right wing. One way to help is to support The Old Mole, which brings you views, reviews, and interviews from the ground up, a perspective that you will not hear on commercial radio. Remember that a group of donors has agreed to match your contribution today, dollar for dollar. You can donate by going to kboo.fm/give, by clicking the red box Donate in the mobile app, by texting KBOO to 44321, or by mailing a check to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, 97214. I'm going to leave you today with Vanessa Kwai's Climate Change International Court of Justice theme song, featuring Stan Antis and Sheila Wills. From the Moles to our listeners, have a safe and happy New Year's Day, and we wish you everything good in the coming year. Thanks for listening.
What does it take for you to see lives are being lost? With all the storms raging, corals dying, ocean levels rising, it's a threat to our human rights.